The Creative Nonfiction Podcast is sponsored by Hippo Camp 2018. Now in its fourth year, Hippo Camp is a three-day Pennsylvania writing conference that features 50-plus speakers, engaging sessions in four tracks, interactive all-conference panels, author and attendee readings, social activities, networking ops, and optional intimate pre-conference workshops. The conference takes place in lovely Lancaster from August 24th through August 26th. Past keynotes have been Lee Gutkind, Mary Carr, Dinty W. Moore, and Jane Friedman. This year, Abigail Thomas will be the featured speaker. Visit hippocampusmagazine.com and click the conference tab in the toolbar. And if you enter the keyword CNFPOD, at checkout, you will receive a $50 discount. This offer is only good through August 10th or until all those tickets are sold. There are a limited number, so act now, like right now. The registration is $429, otherwise $379 with the discount, through August 10th, then goes up to $449 on site. So if you sign up through the portal before the conference starts, you're actually saving $70. Hippo Camp 2018. Create, share, live. Woo! You ready? Let's hit it. Well, well, well. What's going on, CNFers? My CNF buddies. It's Creative Nonfiction Podcast, whereby I interview purveyors of the almighty true story. Today is no different, as I welcome Matt Pence, at Matt Pence on Twitter. That is MATTPENTZ, for episode 107 of the podcast. Matt is a freelance sports writer based out of Seattle. In this episode, we dig into his co-written expose on the U.S. men's soccer team that he wrote with Andrew Helms for TheRinger.com. We get real granular on how he collaborated on that piece, so that's more of the second half of the episode. Hope you dig. We also talk about how he handles his days as a freelancer and other influential writers. Share this episode if you dig. And tag me on social, at Brendan O'Mara and at CNFPod on Twitter. You guys are the social network, so when you share it, I'll know you're digging it. Why wait? Here's Matt Pence. Shortly after the big piece you co-wrote with The Ringer, I caught you on the podcast, too, talking about it, The Ringer FC one, and it was... Hearing you say, you're like, oh, we're just a couple of freelancers who have lots of time on our hands. And I was like, you know, it's a joke, but there's no way he's got a lot of time on his hands. And I'd love to unpack how you go about chronicling or going about your work and setting up your days so you actually don't have a lot of time. Because as a freelancer, when you're not working, you're not earning. So how are you setting up your days now that you're freelancing versus a beat writer or a salaried beat writer?
Yeah, it certainly took, I'd say, about half a year to kind of establish a new rhythm. I started full-time freelancing in February of last year, and it was probably at least through the summer before I really started to kind of find that rhythm, because as you alluded to, pretty much as a freelancer, time is your money, and it's easy to really sort of feel like you should be working all the time or feel guilty for giving yourself downtime. So I just kind of try to set aside a chunk of every day, usually after lunchtime, before dinner time, and devote that to make sure I'm doing something productive during that stretch. And then the rest of it kind of fluctuates. Mm. So there'll be days where I'm productive in the morning and then also do that, or end up working into the evening or doing whatever, but that sort of has helped me having that little bit of structure, if that makes sense.
Yeah, of course. And you said it took you a little while to find that rhythm. So what was that time like for you to establish that rhythm and to try to gain some kind of momentum so you could feel like you were accomplishing something and then setting just getting the right sort of getting that ball uphill, so then you can start, you know, creating your own momentum.
Yeah, I mean, really, it was just throwing a lot at the wall, essentially. So I was just working a lot. I also, even now, I work at a restaurant two nights a week, mm-hmm. To kind of balance out, sort of just to make sure that the income is somewhat regular. There are very few freelancers that you talk to that truly do freelance journalism full time. They either do copywriting for big companies or sort of some other creative field. Whereas for me, I kind of found out that I only have so many good words in me a week. So I wanted to do something with a different part of my brain.
Yeah.
So I ended up doing that on the side. And so I was working there more hours than I was now. Also trying to freelance for all these different outlets to get my foot in the door. So it really took a lot of hustle to get to a point where I could kind of take a critical look at what I was doing and figuring out exactly what I want to do.
That's great. I love that you're comfortable admitting that there is sometimes this extra day job kind of wing to your income. Lots of people don't want to admit that for fear of embarrassment, especially well-educated people. You know, you invest a lot in your college and everything, and to admit that you might have to have something that is maybe not in your field sometimes, I guess, bruises the ego.
I guess for me, I just want to make sure I'm being upfront with everybody, because I have a lot of people reach out, aspiring writers or writers that are working for different outlets now and are intrigued by the idea of freelancing. And to get the full picture of it, I mean, it really does require some sacrifice to some degree. And I feel like it's important to be upfront about what it requires. And for me, I'm totally fine with that. I mean, I enjoy my coworkers. I like the social aspect of getting out and interacting people, because that's another thing, being a freelancer and working on your own time. You spend a lot of time by yourself on a computer.
Yeah.
So that has also kind of helped for me to kind of alleviate some of that sort of isolation that can really be a thing for freelancers.
Yeah, for sure. That loneliness thing is real when you're freelancing and trying to come up with your own ideas, and you're doing everything basically lots of things remotely, especially if you're not in like a major metropolitan area. So what were you doing aside from the job to try to alleviate some of that loneliness and then try to keep those voices of self-doubt as muted as possible?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've just had to be a little bit more aggressive with my social life and really being aggressive and reaching out to friends and trying to set stuff up every so often. Because whenever I was working at the Times, I was lucky enough that some of my best friends in the city also worked for the newspaper. So I get to see them in the office all the time and sort of keep those relationships going that way. So as a freelancer, you just kind of have to work a little bit harder in terms of keeping those connections, forcing yourself out of the house and doing all that. And thankfully I'm a pretty social person. So I've been able to kind of stay on top of that in a lot of ways and make sure that I get out of my apartment every so often.
And what was your approach to querying stories and trying to create opportunity for yourself as you hung up your own shingle?
Yeah, that was certainly due to having a lot of very helpful sort of peers and colleagues that were willing to kind of open some of those doors. And especially within the U.S. soccer journalism community, it's not a particularly big world.
Right.
There are a lot of interconnections there. And whenever I ended up transitioning out of the newspaper, I had a lot of people reach out to me and offer their services if ever they could be of any help. And I just kind of took them up on that a lot of times, asking about maybe the outlets that they were working for or editors that they would recommend reaching out to. And it makes a big difference when you can have that conduit rather than just sort of like cold calling people.
Mm-hmm.
Cause there's only really so much, a lot of these places, I mean, I'm sure that they get lots and lots and lots of emails. So being able to have that previous connection was really helpful for me, at least. And a lot of that, I can't speak highly enough of all the different people that were able to open those doors.
And what was that moment like for you after being, you know, a steady beat writer for, you know, a big paper and then choosing to go out and freelance? You know, what was that inflection point like for you?
Yeah, for sure. And well, and also full disclosure was that it wasn't entirely my choice. I was actually laid off by the newspaper.
Okay.
I was sort of one of the people farther down the totem pole and they got from the bottom and there we were. But for me, I guess you always kind of want to make the best of everything. But for me, I don't know that I had wanted to be a full-time beat writer much longer than I was. Some people really like the day-to-day grind and the day-to-day stories and kind of keeping the news cycle going. Whereas for me, I've always liked the bigger picture stuff, being able to take a step back and write one really detailed story rather than sort of piecing it together day by day. So for me, I just kind of looked at it as an opportunity to make a transition that I had hoped to want to do one day anyway. So it sort of threw me off the deep end and just sort of forced me to figure out if I could make it. And looking back, I think it was definitely a good thing. I mean, I've had a couple good stories that I'm proud of. I have actually a book coming out in March of next year on the Sounders, and I never would have had the time to be able to do that or any of this other stuff had I still been working for the Times on the beat. So as with anything, you make the most of it. But for me, I think it was kind of a natural step I needed to make in my career.
I know that doing breaking news stuff and that type of reporting just has never appealed to me in any way. It just doesn't suit my taste for what that's worth. And sometimes you just come to a realization that, you know, the nature of your talent, just some people thrive on that and other people don't. And I wonder, how did you come to the realization and realize the nature of your talent, which appears to be these more deeply reported long form pieces? Like, how did you arrive at that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just trial and error mostly, and just kind of taking a hard look at what you're good at and what you're not. I mean, I know some really good reporters like Bob Condotta, works for the Seattle Times. He's their Seahawks beat reporter, and that guy is just a machine. Like, he can turn some Thursday in the off season and crank out 5 posts somehow. And some people just have it, and I just have never. That's just something that through working on the beat and through sort of that day-to-day grind that you just kind of find out about yourself that maybe that's not where your strengths lie. And then you kind of have to make up for that in other ways. So that kind of nudged me to do the bigger picture things. And then there's sort of a pressure that comes with that. Cause if you're going to be writing less often, you have to make sure it really sings. So it sort of forces you to hone in and work hard in your own way. So I think that just for me, that process just kind of came about through sort of hands-on experience, I guess.
And who were you reading maybe as a student and as an aspiring writer that sort of fed into your taste and your desire to write the kind of stuff you're doing now?
Yeah, I'm sure that this is a pretty common answer for a lot of sort of sports writers of my generation, but I think that Wright Thompson was always kind of the guy that was doing, I think, sort of the A number one best stuff when it came to that. I had a friend send me the other day during the Uruguay game. He had sent me back around the profile that Wright had done of him in 2014, and I read it back, and he's such a good writer and really sort of sees the world in a certain way that I identify with, and I certainly don't think that I'm anywhere near his level at this point, something to strive for. But I think that he just sort of sees sports in a different way and sees them sort of as a window to some of these bigger picture topics. And sort of, he was a guy that when you saw him making it and you looked at his job and you think that it's out there. I mean, it's certainly, there aren't as many of those jobs as there once were. And there's only so much of that to go around, but he sort of proved that you could do it and you could write in this certain way and make it feasible for you.
And when you're reading a piece of journalism of that nature by him specifically, because it sounds like, you know, he's the type of guy you're rereading as well, how do you turn your critical eye onto that so you can start to deconstruct it and unpack it so you can apply some of those tools that you're discovering in those pieces?
For sure. I think that probably the first time I read something, I just kind of try to enjoy it and unplug your brain to a certain degree. But then I think that my process, at least, is whenever I'm working on some big story idea that it sort of triggers something in your mind that, oh, it's sort of similar to this story that I read whenever. So you go back and sort of read that, and then you look for clues that way. Like, for example, for The Athletic, I'm working on a Clint Dempsey feature. It's not too over the top, but still a little bit in-depth reported story. And the idea came out of Sam Borden's profile on Lionel Messi that he wrote for ESPN, the magazine, before the World Cup. And sort of the entire premise of the story is that because Messi is so guarded and so private, he doesn't like to say a lot, but in a lot of ways that says a lot about him, that he's not out there giving too many interviews or on too many ads or whatever. He really does kind of like to keep it to himself. And so what does that say about him? And then I wanted to apply sort of that same question to Clint Dempsey, because he really kind of has had a very similar mentality and a very similar persona for a lot of years. And so then you go back and you read his story and see what he did. And then you try to pick up and emulate some of that in your own stuff.
So with a story like that you're working on with Clint Dempsey, who is not as, like you were saying, like Messi, not quite as mainstream, not quite as on the forefront and self-promoting. How are you pitching him a story that you want to write about him and getting him on board?
Yeah, I mean, Dempsey's a good question, because he's not very open at all. I mean, this is one of those stories that's reported mostly around him, honestly. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of part of the point. Having covered him now for, more than 3.5 years, give or take, since he came out here, you just sort of learn that he's not really going to be on board with really anything. He just kind of wants to keep to himself and be left alone. And even if you do get him to sit down, he's really not going to open up or tell you much. So he's a little bit more of a challenge for a reporter, in that he makes you think super creatively to tell these stories and to make his story interesting, just because he's not really going to let you in. So for me, a lot of this has been reporting around him, which is both a good challenge and a bad, and it's a challenge, I think.
My experience with that is it's not very extensive, but it's almost kind of fun. Like when your central figure is the one that you don't really have much access to, and it's just like, Talese's Frank Sinatra Has a Cold and all that. It tends to, I think, give a more well-rounded thing when you're getting other people's impressions of your central figure. So what's your approach to that kind of reporting and trying to get some nice, you know, tangible, beautiful details from the satellite figures of your main figure?
And a lot of it's just sort of relationships and having been around. I mean, as someone who's been around the Sounders for a decent amount of time here, like, I just kind of know which guys to go to that will give me good detail when it comes to a lot of that, which is really helpful, I think. I feel like you were kind of talking earlier about sort of the lessons that you take from some of these stories that you read from a Wright Thompson or some of these really well-reported ones. It's just sort of, you realize that the good stuff just comes down to the work that you put in is what comes out. You can think to yourself that, oh, well, Wright Thompson's such a talented natural writer, and he could probably just sit down and write it tomorrow if you wanted to. But it really does come down to the reporting and the work that you put in and the amount of voices you're willing to talk to really flesh out this portrait. And so for a story like that, that's especially important, because the more perspectives that you can get, the more that that's going to come true, and the more that you can sort of tell that true, accurate story about someone, even if they themselves don't want to get too involved.
Yeah, when I read a long, say, New Yorker profile or something, sometimes I'll take out a highlighter and I'll highlight every individual source in there, and then you find out that over the course of a 6 or an 8 or a 10,000 word piece, that there are just dozens upon dozens of sources that are actually just in there quoted, and who knows how many people have been spoken to that are just giving some background information. So sometimes these great tacticians of the words, it feels like they're just conjuring all the stuff. But when you really boil it down and reduce it to its essence, you found that the writing is so good because the reporting was so extensive.
Yes, 100%. And that's something that I think that, the more and more involved as I get in doing more and more in-depth, longer stories, like, that is something that cannot be forced, and it will always show through whether the holes in your reporting or the amount of reporting that go into it, that's always going to come through at the end. And again, I think more than looking at stylistic stuff, I sort of identify with you in that whenever I read a story like that, I now have a sense for how much work went into it. And I think that it allows me to appreciate them a little bit more that they were able to pull that off, because it's certainly not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, and it gives you some hope, actually. You're like, oh, yeah, you know, it was kind of like you were saying earlier, like the, you know, it's work to do it. And the more work you put in, it's like work, you know, effort in gives you this a much better result. So you see, you start to see the work that goes into it. And then through rewrites and refining, it becomes what it is. And then it kind of gives you some hope that, oh, if I just grind on this and show a lot of rigor and tenacity, like, I can do this too.
For sure. It definitely sort of levels the playing field to some degree. It's also a little bit daunting whenever you think that it does take a lot of work, and it you have to be willing to do that. And I think that in many ways it does kind of, it does sort of separate the wheat from the chaff or whatever, and sort of winnowing down the people that are willing to do it. And you sort of recognize why that skill is so valuable.
Yeah. And the piece that you wrote for The Ringer, co-wrote with Andrew Helms, you got 10,000 word feature that is, you know, very expository, kind of an expose of what happened to the U.S. men's national team and how they, you know, how it kind of fell apart in the last 7 years. So how did you and Andrew come to this story? And then we can start unpacking some of the details of it at that point.
For sure. I mean, it really just kind of arose from a casual phone call. It's also another sort of blessing in disguise example, because I had actually planned on going to Russia to cover the World Cup, and I had talked to ESPN, and we had some advanced talks about me going and covering the tournament, which would have been great. I mean, that would have been such a cool experience to be able to do that. Would love, and especially as amazing as this World Cup has been, would have loved to have been there. So watching that game in Trinidad and having everything happen the way that it did, and it really was bummed out for sort of even a week, just not only as a fan of American soccer, but also professionally and personally, it really did sort of just put an end to something I really wanted to do. And so I was just sort of talking to a lot of different friends in the American soccer community, and we were all sort of lamenting together. And I had known Andrew for a couple years. He also worked as a producer for PBS, and he was visiting Seattle from some story 2 or 3 years ago. And he had just asked to meet up and get a beer and just sort of build the network, because he had read some of my stuff and we had met up and kept in touch. And so we had talked over the phone, and we were just kind of going back and forth, just sort of trying to unpack sort of the central question of that story, which is what happened. I mean, how was it possible that the U.S., with all of its advantages, it's fallen short against not only just Trinidad, but falling below Panama and Honduras to get knocked out in the way that they did. And just sort of both of us were just kind of like, well, like, maybe we should tell that story. There aren't a lot of people within the community that really have the bandwidth to really dig in and devote the amount of time necessary to tell that story. And me as a freelancer, he was transitioning into freelancing, just kind of decided to start poking around, and we were able to have a couple different conversations with people early on in the process that really encouraged us that there was something there. And then it all just kind of built from there.
So what was the actual pitching process like for the two of you, and then how did you ultimately land it at The Ringer?
Yeah, I mean, we pitched it a number of different places, and sort of building off of something that you asked earlier about it being a little bit of a niche sport, it can be a little bit tough to really go and have people latch onto it. I mean, we had one of the bigger magazines. We had approached them. We had approached sort of every sort of big outlet that you can imagine, just sort of pitching our idea. And we had spent even probably the first couple months honing in on exactly the story that we wanted to tell. And we were originally pitching it as a 4,000, 5,000 word story. And even at that length, there weren't many outlets that really were that interested. There are a couple that oh, maybe you can tell just the specific story of that night in Trinidad for 1,500 words, 2,000 words, but we just don't think that the casual interest is going to be there for readers beyond that. So we could have decided to do that, but we did really want to, if we were going to do it, we wanted to do it right, and we wanted to tell that full story. Eventually, Andrew had a contact at The Ringer, brought it to them, and they seemed not only interested in it at 4,000 words, they were really encouraging in being right to the length that you think is appropriate. We really like the idea. You have our backing, go and do your thing. And that was probably in January, give or take. And then, yeah, just kind of really dug in and spent the next couple months really fleshing it out.
And for people who might not be familiar familiar with having a co-reporter and a co-writer on a story, what was that process like, and how did you divide up the reporting and the research?
For sure. And it was new to me as well. This was sort of a first time. I had never worked with someone in that capacity before. And thankfully, I think that me and Andrew's skill sets balanced each other out really well. He's based in Washington, D.C., and he's been a little bit more around the background figures, the people within the Federation, people that were around Sunil Gulati. He just sort of was plugged into that part of it, whereas I had covered MLS for 2.5-3 years and had access to most of the players. So it really just kind of came down to naturally, I reached out and talked to most of the players. He reached out and talked to a lot of the people behind the scenes, and it just kind of worked out that way. And then once we had all the interviews done, once we got down to the writing stage, we just kind of broke it up by section, kind of being like, oh, because you did more of this reporting, maybe write this section and then I can go in and edit and rewrite. And we just kind of went back and forth on sections. So it really ended up being a much smoother process than I thought it might be. And we really didn't butt heads about workflow or you're going to do this or I'm going to do that very often, which I thought was good.
Yeah, and the story too, it doesn't feel, and this is a testament to the two of you, it doesn't feel like two writers wrote it. It does feel nice and uniform, like a uniform voice throughout the whole thing. And so what was that process like as you tried to maybe iron out the wrinkles between you and Andrew?
For that, I think that a lot of credit is due to our editors at The Ringer, because they were really, really good in sort of fleshing that out and really honing in. Like, we had submitted a rough draft that we felt comfortable with, but it was a little bit disjointed, and we were really sort of leaning on them to help guide the way. And they did a really good job in helping us to sort of find that specific voice in that specific story that we were trying to tell. We went through pretty extensive edits. I mean, probably went back and forth 3 or 4 times with really extensive edits before we even got into the copy editing process. So I think I'm really happy with the way that it worked out. I think that at The Ringer, that was sort of the outlet that it was meant to be at, just because they empowered us to write long, and then they really helped hone in on the story we wanted to tell.
And based on the nature, and it's fairly, you know, sensitive stuff to the people involved in the story, so how are you approaching players and management, and knowing that you were going to write something that wasn't going to be very flattering for the whole the U.S. men's soccer? So how are you navigating those conversations so people, even if there was going to be anonymous, that they would feel comfortable talking to you?
For sure. And I think for us, that was the most challenging thing of this whole process, because again, you're not really telling a feel good story. You're pretty much going to people and you're like, oh, tell us how you screwed up. And shockingly, it turns out that not a lot of people want to discuss their collective failure at length, typically. So it really just kind of came down to relationships and connections at the end of the day, just because using sort of players to vouch for other players. And someone like Brad Evans, for example, I covered with Seattle for a couple years. We had a really good working relationship together. And so I sort of started with him, and he provided some really helpful context. And he's always been just a really intelligent speaker and provides a good perspective. And then through him, I was able to kind of have him reach out to a couple different guys and be like, you can trust these guys. It'll be all right. But that was really the most challenging part of it. And really, it just required hearing a lot of no's. Mm. I mean, for every voice that we were able to include in the story, there were five that wouldn't talk to us at all and another couple that would only speak deep on background. So it really was just a process of chipping away at getting all of these necessary perspectives.
Yeah, that kind of gets to the next point I want to talk to you about was, in a sense, like, how are you ending these phone calls too? Are you asking them, like, who else should I talk to? Or are you, like, in the case of Evans, saying, can you talk to a few of the other guys? I'd love to get their perspectives.
Yeah, typically both. Sort of just my process in general, I typically do, as a matter of practice, try to, at the end of most interviews, ask them who else I should talk to get their perspectives. I think that that's really helpful. In this case, it was A, who should we talk to? And B, can you put in a good word? Kind of became our process down the line, and that ended up working for us to some degree.
Mm. And of course, you tried to reach out to Klinsmann, who's a big figure of this, sort of the maligned former coach who came in, tried to change the culture and really busted up a locker room and, kind of was the spearhead of the downward spiral. And so what were the emails or the phone calls as you were trying to get Klinsmann to speak to you to at least get his perspective? And ultimately he didn't. But what conversations were you having to try to recruit him into this story?
For sure. And sort of to build off the question that you just asked is how did you pitch this to people? For both Klinsmann and Bruce Arena, who was the other sort of central coaching figure in the story. We really did just sort of say, this is the type of stuff that we have. And it really would, I think for both of them, it would have behooved them to talk to us and give us their perspective, because you're never going to let them take charge of your entire narrative. But whenever you do talk to people and get to know what they were thinking at this specific point in time, you do become a little bit more sympathetic to them typically. And that does allow you to guide the story a little bit. So that was sort of our pitch to a lot of the people, was that, A, we're trying to tell as honest and truthful of a story as possible. And then B, in a lot of ways, it would be helpful for you to sort of provide your own sort of voice and perspective on it so that we can kind of understand where you were coming from. And ultimately, neither one of those guys decided to do that. We talked to so many people around them, whether they're assistant coaches or agents or some of the players, to really get a sense, I think, of where they were at. It was another one of those processes of got really close. At one point, it seemed like Klinsmann might want to talk to us, but ended up not coming through. And yeah, that was another one of those knows I mentioned, even though we certainly tried, I think as hard as we could have.
It's what impressed me so much about this story too, as long as it is in terms of, word count, there actually, for something this long, there isn't a whole lot of scenes, your classic building blocks of long narrative. Like it is a lot of exposition and quotes from people. And that sometimes is, without a lot of scene, is very hard to garner momentum and pull people along. So how did you and Andrew create momentum and pace the story, given that there isn't a lot of, action-based scenes?
I think that we both sort of recognized that in our own writing. Neither one of us, I guess I had just finished the book, which is sort of a whole other process, and that was certainly a long endeavor too, but we had never, either one of us, written anything in the range from between 4,000 and 10,000 words. This was kind of new for both of us. And whenever our first draft or two, it was a lot of exposition. There wasn't nearly enough scene. And so even the sort of limited scenes that ended up getting in there, we just sort of recognized that weakness in our writing and were able to sort of pinpoint, this is where we need to be able to tell a little bit more of a story. So that was just kind of part of the process for us, I think, was identifying where we could sort of build that narrative. And then our editors were also really good, too, at identifying, you need to stretch this scene out a little bit. here's where you can drop some of that exposition in. So it really did come together as part of a process. But I would say of the writing process, that was the biggest challenge for both of us, just because telling that type of narrative was new for us both.
With all the reporting you were doing, all the interviews, are you using a tape recorder and then transcribing yourself, or are you a notebook guy strictly?
I have a recorder going in the background typically. I usually try to transcribe live as much as I can whenever I'm talking to someone, but I also kind of have the recorder going in the background to make sure that so go back and listen to everything and make sure I have everything exactly right. But I try as much as possible to pull out quotes here and there that I'm ultimately going to use.
Mm-hmm. And how are you organizing all your notes so you can have the best access to them to then craft your story?
Yeah, we had a shared Google Doc that sort of everything went into and sort of became multiple different sections and multiple different documents and multiple drafts along the way. But that's how we ended up doing it. And I definitely am thankful to have had someone like Andrew who had worked for PBS on a couple different documentaries. So he kind of had a template for how you keep everything organized and how you sort of structure all these different things so you don't get too lost in the weeds. And I think that he was really helpful with that, just sort of like having these outlines. And when it came to the structure and the note-taking and everything else, we really just kind of did plug things into this shared Google Doc that grew into this massive thing with a lot of different alleyways in it. But I think that having some kind of template like you had was definitely helpful for us.
And how did you keep things straight as you were then getting really into the thick of this piece? You know, midway through, you're too far along to turn back, and you're still far away from the finish line. So how are you navigating that middle?
For sure. And that was definitely a challenge, because I think that within our reporting process, it kind of ended up kind of being a bell curve. I guess it would be the opposite of a bell curve, in that people seemed really willing to talk about all this in sort of the months after the Trinidad game when we first started reporting, because everybody, the emotions were still high. Everybody was still really upset about what happened. So we got all that and we were like, oh yeah, like there's enough here to actually go off of. We construct our pitch. We spend a couple months getting that honed in and finding an outlet. And then when we started to double back, a lot of people had kind of shut down. They're like, oh, well, it's in the past now. We're not sure we want to talk about it. So that's whenever we really had to get used to dealing with rejection and pushing through, because we had sort of an early draft that it was thin. I mean, like we talked about earlier, you can always tell the holes in reporting and how much work's being put in to the really good stories. And there came a point where we tried a draft, it wasn't quite there. And then we really did kind of have to take another. That was probably sometime around March, and then really April and the beginning of May, digging down and doubling back with people and doing a lot more calling and reporting to really flesh everything out. So certainly we kind of had to take stock midway through the process to see where we were at. And we kind of did recognize that we were really going to have to double down and go back and sort of chase down a lot of these loose ends if we really wanted to tell that story right.
Did you run into any interactions where people were open to talking early, and then as you were doubling back, like you were saying, like they're kind of lukewarm, did they at that point want to rescind everything they said and then you'd have to kind of start over?
Thankfully, not too much of that. At least, no, I think that Andrew had a little bit more difficulty that with some of the higher ups. But for me, with the players, there wasn't a point where they're like, oh, I take back all of my sentiments from last November. It was more that like, I've said my piece. I don't want to get any more into this.
Gotcha.
And so with that, I really just kind of had to figure out who among the guys was willing to kind of go back and talk a little bit more. I mean, most of the guys that ended up being quoted in there, from Evans to Benny Failhaber to Dax McCarty, three guys who ended up providing a lot of good context and good scene, it really did require identifying those handful of guys, convincing them that they should trust us with the story, and then sort of building out from there.
And in the early drafting phases of this, and you know, you had your various sections, are you guys emailing the, or either through Google Docs or email, are you emailing each document and then the one person edits and then it keeps going back and forth like a tennis match?
Yeah, so we had so actually within, like, Google Docs is sort of an amazing resource when it comes to a lot of this. I don't even know how we would have done this even 5 years ago, let alone farther back than that when it came to writing and rewriting and all that. But so within Google Docs, you can just create a document, give both of you access to it, and then the stuff that you worked on shows up in a different color, essentially. Mm-hmm. So we just kind of had... I think we ended up with 7 different versions of drafts. We had version 1 where we would both go in and kind of collaborate on that. One of us would say, oh, I think we should go in a different direction with the structure, copy and paste into version 2 and work from there. So it was just kind of a process of us both having access to these shared documents and sort of collaborating through there, if that makes sense.
Given the experience you had with this, is this... something you would want to tackle again, either with Andrew or somebody else?
For sure. I think that I would, just because, again, sort of figuring out exactly how much work goes into doing something like this, it makes it a little bit less daunting looking ahead and sort of trying to map out my next big thing, which I'm not entirely sure what my next project's going to be exactly, but I think that I would definitely do it again. I think that it definitely gave me an awareness that I would want to be careful in identifying who I could work with and who I couldn't. And just sort of recognizing within some of your friends whose strengths complement each other. Like one of my very best friends out here, Jason Jenks, he worked for the Seattle Times doing features for them for a long time and does a lot of good stuff. He's writing for The Athletic now. On a full-time basis, so we sort of are co-writers there in a lot of ways. But I identify that when it comes to a project like this, I don't think me and Jason would mesh very well at all, just because we see things so similar and have such a similar skill set and would sort of probably interview people in roughly the same way. So I think that I would be a lot more careful in identifying what writer I could work with that would sort of bring out each other's strengths. In a way that I think that me and Andrew were able to, which is good.
And given the amount of work you did on this, and I'm sure for some people who follow soccer, you know, with, you know, a foaming at the mouth rabidity, where do you see U.S. soccer going, and, you know, where does your optimism lie with it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that within the next sort of talent cycle, I think there's a lot there. I think that sort of the age group between 16 and 20 right now, there's a lot of really talented guys. Christian Pulisic, who is one of the sort of central characters in our story, is kind of the young up and coming star, is still only 19. So there's a lot to be excited about when it comes to the next World Cup cycle. And then you look ahead to 2026 with the joint hosted World Cup that's been awarded to the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. And that's only going to ramp up everything in terms of interest and investment and all of that. So I think that there's a lot to be positive about in that sense. But I think that what our story tried to do, more than just pinning the blame on sort of just one person's failings, like a Klinsmann or a Sunil Gulati, what we kind of wanted to point out was that the structure within the organization was flawed. Power so centralized within U.S. soccer to a degree that one man, Sunil Gulati, the former president, was able to just sort of unilaterally roll with this coach that everyone kind of knew that the wheels were coming off. And if there had been a couple of different voices in that room, maybe it all would have ended differently. So I think that the structure of the organization is flawed, and I don't know that they've done much to address that. They sort of done a little bit of a review. They're adding a new position called the general manager that's supposed to be a little bit more of an overseer of coaching hires and all that kind of stuff. But I think that structurally, the flaws that allowed this failure to take place are still there. And I think they're going to be really resistant to meaningful change, because if they didn't change after this massive, massive letdown, they're probably not going to. And they might sort of ultimately hamper the U.S.'s ability to go on and become a Germany or a France or a team that can really go and win the World Cup and win a great championship like that. So I think that we're on an upward trajectory. I think that the U.S. national team will end up having a good showing at the next World Cup and maybe shoot for the quarterfinals or ideally the semis in 2026. But with the way that things are going within the Federation, I think that that is about our absolute ceiling, unless they really do start to break up the power structure a little bit.
Wow. And lastly, before I let you get out of here, Matt, where can people find you and your work online?
Yeah, so I have a Twitter. It's Matt, just twitter.com, and then Matt Pence is my handle, no dots or anything like that. So I sort of try to consolidate everything there. I'm writing regularly for The Athletic, sort of the sports news startup, so you'll sort of see a lot of my stuff on there. And then, yeah, it just kind of bounces all over the place. But definitely Twitter is sort of the best way to kind of dig out all the different stuff I'm working on, and that's probably where I would tell people to go.
Awesome. Well, this was really illuminating stuff, and it was awesome to hear you unpack how you and Andrew went about writing the story, and then also just hearing your approach to freelancing. So thank you very much for the time, and when your book comes out in 2019, we'll have to have you back on and talk a little more shop and talk about the book.
Yeah, for sure. And thank you for reaching out to me and for thinking of me, and I appreciated it. And for sure, I will definitely double back whenever that comes down the pike here.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again, Matt, and we'll be in touch. Yeah. Thank you for listening, everybody. If you dig the show, consider leaving an honest review on Apple Podcasts and sharing it with a friend and across your social networks. Reach out on the socials if you have questions, concerns, or feedback. You can email me too. Also, if you head over to BrendanOmara.com, not only will you find show notes for every episode of this podcast, but you can sign up for the ever-growing monthly reading list newsletter, where I share my book recommendations for the month, as well as what you might have missed from the world of the podcast. Once a month, no spam. Can't beat it. Have a CNF and great week, friends. See ya!